This is the Management 291 podcast, Surviving Organizational Behavior, produced by governanceproject.org.
Hi, Anthony.
Hello, Michael.
Looks like we've made it to the end of the semester.
It's the end of the semester, and we've left the best subject to last.
Indeed, ethics.
Ethics.
In fact, it might not be the last, because this actually follows you through your entire career.
Yeah, and I think actually there are bits of ethics that have been following us through the whole entire podcast series as well.
That's right.
To date. So ethics is, if you like, the be-all and end-all of many, many, many other topics. So I think we better dive into the first question, the eternal question of what is ethics?
Ethics. So we of course, each have our own individual set of ethics, and we arrive at work with those ethics. And those, of course, you know, those come from many different sources, our collective experiences, education, upbringing, etc., and stays with us when we get to work. So what is ethics? It's, you know, it's your internal radar. It's your internal guidance system. It's what you turn to when you need to make a decision. It's what you turn to understand what the right decision is. That's how I describe ethics.
Mm-hmm. That is correct. Full marks, Michael. Well done. It's also, to my mind, it goes a bit further than that as well, if you want to get philosophical about it, because I always like to bring up the question of, are you ethical? Michael, are you ethical?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Am I ethical?
Of course.
Of course. Person number three, are they ethical?
Probably not.
Or let's say that they are. The trouble is that we won't have the same ethics.
That's right.
We will all be ethics by our own measurement and my own benchmarks. And those benchmarks, they are different because we come from different backgrounds, have different experiences, different influences on what we have as a sense of right and wrong. And therein lies the big problem of how to discuss and agree on the subject of ethics at a deeper level than just superficial Ten Commandments level.
That's right. And then if we try to discuss, you know, what kind of ethics does a particular organization have? Well, an organization is composed of individuals who each have their own sense of ethics, or have their own ethics, and, you know, may not be compatible. How do you decide on one set of ethics for an organization?
Yeah, and we've seen, when we look at the way people do recruitment policies, it's been very popular in the last 5-10 years to have recruits, potential recruits, to do various kinds of personality profiling, to be tested on what their values might be, with the idea of hiring a homogeneous set of people who can easily identify with each other's ethics and culture and way of behaviors. But at the same time, that goes completely against the message we've been giving in this course about the necessity to have diversity, which is a little bit of a problem.
That's right. And you have to ask the question, the testing that's done when you go through the recruitment process, you know, is that calibrated appropriately to deal with an applicant from another background, another country, another experience? I think that's a very challenging model to develop.
Yeah. I think if anything, there's a few red lines that run through this series of podcasts so far, Michael. And one of them is clearly diversity is good. But if we have diversity, that means we're inviting in people with different sets of values, different ways of behavior, different ways of viewing the facts on the table to interpret them differently. This is a good thing in many ways. The problem is that if we do not have a homogeneous set of people, all recruited from the same background with the same conventions and the same influences on what they believe to be correct behavior, then we need to be a little bit more demonstrative about what behavior is. And here comes the discussion around codes of conduct and so forth.
Yeah. And we get a lot of cues at work in terms of what are the ethics at work. Is it a code of conduct that explains to us what the right things are and what the wrong things are? Is it the message that you get from senior leaders, from the CEO? What do we tell the public? What do we tell our customers about our ethics? And so employees are watching all of this. They're listening to all of this. And that's how really we start to understand at work what our ethics at a particular company is. And you can do a lot of work in terms of trying to educate employees about what a particular company's ethics might be. But ultimately, the best way to really promote those ethics is to hold people in your organization accountable when they go offside of those ethics. Those are the moments when employees are watching with absolute focus and attention to see how you're going to respond to an ethical situation. They are watching that 100% and will judge how you react to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the essence of holding people accountable for their actions drives very strong in any study you'll see about how do you create an ethical organization. The way in which you decide what those behavioral patterns that are approved or disapproved of, how you define how they are, that's also an interesting subject in the sense that in a small company, it's generally infused in the organization through the founder mm-hmm. of the company, who will behave in a certain way and will be seen to behave in a certain way. Everybody will observe that conduct, and without any kind of written communication, it'll just be communicated, this is what is the way we behave. So if it's particularly customer orientated, everyone will copy that. If it is particularly quality oriented, that'll be the ethics that'll drive the value that'll drive the ethics and the behavior of the company. It really is a question of role models and observed behaviors at the end of the day.
And that applies to large companies too. In large companies, there's more of a support in terms of, you know, talking about what the ethics and values of the company are. But in fact, individual leaders and managers are role modeling from the moment they drive their car into the garage in the morning, the time it takes to get them in the lift up to the floor, how they interact with staff, support staff, how they interact with difficult situations. They're being judged. They're being watched. And this really sets the tone. It's also how you can end up with sort of subcultures and with different sets of ethics if you're not careful.
Yeah, I think that rounds back to our original question about what is ethics, because ethic is nothing if it isn't a question of adhering to the expected patterns of behavior. So if someone is setting down the rules, it could be by role modeling and by demonstrating themselves how to behave. Or it can be by having policies and values and codes of conduct that tell you exactly what it is. But basically, to be ethical in any company, and I think you could expand this to any country or any other social grouping, to be ethical is simply to adhere to the expected behavioral patterns. Because that has to be clear,
yeah,
whichever it is. And I think that also explains why you can have two different companies, both will be ethical in their situation. You can have two different countries, both, you can't accuse one of being unethical and the other one of being ethical.
It's just different.
It's just a reflection of their values and the way they do things and the way their conventions are.
That's right.
Does it matter, Michael? I mean, we see a lot of companies these days who hire people on short-term contracts, on a gig economy basis. They don't invest in those people to teach them the ethical standards of the company. They don't necessarily, apart from on a contract basis, say what is expected of them. They might ask them to sign a code of conduct. That's true. But does it actually matter? Why can't people just simply be saying, look, be ethical, be correct, and end of story? Why does it matter for organizations to focus on ethics?
Yeah, it does matter. In 2019, every organization needs to be seen as having nothing but completely ethical conduct. That's absolutely critical from a reputational perspective.
It's been really accentuated by social media and the way in which bad news travels so fast these days.
Exactly.
Faster than ever.
So, having an ethical culture is table stakes, or being perceived as having an ethical culture is table stakes. That's very different from having a robust, strategic, ethical culture that you've developed inside of your company. So the examples you used, you know, onboarding short-term employees and having them sign a code of conduct, for me that has very little to do with ethics. I suppose if if nothing else, that that person could maybe refer to that code of conduct if they needed a reference guide, but I can't really see its practical value. Ethics is really so much more than that. It's a deeper understanding of how the place works and, as you said, what the accepted norms are.
Yeah, there is a difference between ethics in its purest sense and compliance on the other. Compliance indicates that there is a set of rules that have to be adhered to, which can, without a deeper understanding of why those rules are in place, which is where you move over towards the ethical sphere. But if you don't have that deeper understanding of why the rules are in place, it just becomes a procedure for box ticking.
Yeah, and you see this in every time there's a scandal, you see the press release. And the press release always reads, we are very disappointed that our longstanding and very important employee chose to do the following things which were unethical. This is disappointing as it is not consistent with our code of conduct.
Yeah.
And we hold our code of conduct and our employees to the highest standards, and we're taking steps to ensure this doesn't happen again.
Right.
And you know, we see that press release once a week. For me, meaningless.
Yeah. More often than not, it's a question of the employee has acted in accordance with observed behavior by others as opposed to what is written in the code of conduct.
Exactly.
And there's usually something wrong with the culture that is driving a different behavior than that which is espoused, that is advertised in the shop windows or in the policy documents that are not taken very seriously.
And I actually almost, I'm a little bit concerned with the speed of which people consider these scandals and issues when they come up. You know, we're very quick to say someone has misbehaved and it wasn't in alignment with the code of conduct. I think actually we need to hold organizations more accountable than that, because actually it seems awfully convenient to simply refer out to your code of conduct when actually you might need to be making more fundamental and strategic changes inside of your organization.
Yeah, I don't want to make this personal, Michael, in terms of a compliance versus law kind of discussion, but very often you get companies that will emphasize that training has been given, people have signed documents, and therefore the company is no longer responsible for the actions of that individual. Whereas from a compliance perspective, it's more about what are the behaviors, generally speaking, in the organization? Do you actually hold responsibility towards them?
No, and I'm okay with that, Anthony, because what you just said is true. It might be true that the company is no longer legally responsible for whatever has occurred. I guess the question we have to ask ourselves is, you know,
are they ethically concerned?
Yeah, do we have anything? Are we concerned about anything other than what's, you know, acceptable from a bare legal minimum? I hope so.
Yeah, so we're talking about irrespective of whether someone has acted in accordance with their contract or outside their contract, whether they have been advised that something is not supposed to be done but they have done it anyway. When you talk about ethical impact, how would you hold a company up that we have to talk about a difference maybe between legal compliance and moral responsibility?
Yeah, this one's tough because, I mean, what do? You measure the number of breaches of the code of conduct per year and then run a comparison across companies to say that one is better than the other because they had fewer breaches. This seems to me to be really difficult to put into practice.
Mm-hmm. It is difficult to put into practice. I think you can measure the impact of, I think what you need to put front and center of any evaluation of how well your ethical culture or your ethical standards are performing is to consider how does the behaviors that our culture produces impact our clients, impact employees generally, impact our suppliers, community around us. How does it impact our performance in the sense that if you have a good, healthy culture, you're going to have much more openness to frank discussions and confronting problems earlier rather than later. The degree of trust and confidence that you can speak up about issues will be much greater rather than just faced with a have you followed procedures or not, I don't care about anything else kind of discussion. So you have to go away from key performance indicators like sales figures or profit figures, etc. And you have to start talking to everybody about how we're behaving. What's our attitude towards each other? Is this a nice place to be? Do you trust your managers? And these kind of discussions, of course, can't be measured very easily. You can do, of course, course, surveys, but that's also a soft science, at least so far.
Okay, so far we've talked about, you know, different sets of ethics, and we've tried to figure out how we might measure what kind of an ethical impact we have. I think now we come to the heart of the issue. You know, why do people do what they do? Why do they misbehave? What's going on there?
Yeah, I mean, there's the famous fraud triangle, right, where we talk about opportunity, pressure, and rationalization. And I think maybe we should briefly talk about each one. Firstly, people do not do something wrong unless they see the opportunity for it. Now, the question is, what would make someone take the opportunity or not? Okay, so first thing is there has to be opportunity, but there will always be. The reality is that there will always be an opportunity for doing the wrong thing as well as doing the right thing.
It sort of goes, the expression, you know, locks are for honest people.
Correct, yes. So what we're talking about is, what is it that's pressurizing them? What is it that's maybe motivating them to take that opportunity and to do something, even if at some point in their consciousness they know it's the wrong thing to do? And those pressures, of course, can be manifold. And we've seen so many examples almost every week. I mean, we talked before in the series about Boeing. We've talked about Wells Fargo, I think, where the sales targets were absolutely irrationally high and people were trying to save their jobs by meeting them and opening fraudulent accounts for customers. All the time you see people are being pressured. There can be pressures at work. There can be pressures at home. People can have financial troubles at home. They can have gambling debts. They can have a divorce going on, which makes them twisted in their evaluation. But I think the most fascinating one and the most dangerous element of the fraud triangle is the human ability to rationalize action, to say it's okay, what I'm doing is perfectly normal.
And actually, as you go through the behavior, it actually becomes easier and easier and easier. Once you've rationalized the first time, you can keep going.
Yeah.
And it becomes easier as you go through it.
Yeah, because you've justified to yourself that what you're doing is actually okay.
Yes. Well, or even in some cases more than okay, it might be well deserved.
Yeah. So, in the sense of, I deserve to be paid more, and therefore I'm now going to steal office supplies or toilet rolls. Or it can be, well, yes, we know that they talk about the fact we're not allowed to commit bribery, but we all know that's the way you get business done. And if I don't do it, in fact, I'll be look as though I'm letting the side down.
Yeah, and we've talked about a lot of scandals. Bribery is a good one where, you know, regularly we see the newspaper headline where a large corporate has been found guilty of bribery, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. And you say to yourself, well, what went on there? How could they have thought that this would have been considered ethical conduct in any way? And so obviously having rules against this, or a code of conduct that says this kind of activity isn't allowed, I suppose it's part of the puzzle. But clearly policing it is near impossible. So how do you get employees to, you know, to be ethical every day at work? It's a bit of a big question, I appreciate, but unless if you arm your employees with some guidance on ethical conduct, you know, I just don't see how you can avoid it.
Yeah, this is, of course, the very big question, and companies are struggling with this all the time. The first thing you need to have, I think, at the very, very top of the organization, and it really has to be authentic and genuine, that is a commitment to endorse an ethical culture, to make sure that we are doing the right thing. That if that is not believed at the top, it'll permeate the whole organization. This is just window dressing and is not serious. So I think, as we said before, people will take their cue from observed behaviors of other people. And those observed behaviors from other people must be exemplary. So we talked about, you mentioned before, that in fact acting on misconduct, holding people to account, is really, really important. Showing understanding for errors, for mistakes, allowing people to feel maybe not happy, but comfortable with coming forward with things that are not working out right. Projects, experiments that are not working, not functioning as they would have hoped them to. It can't be an environment where you feel you're being punished. So what we're talking about is an environment where people can talk openly about what's going on, where they can question orders, where they can question the direction of travel, and where they can express themselves relative to their own ethical preferences. There's got to be an environment where people feel the role models at the top are walking the talk, giving the right message, giving clarity as to what expected behavior is, and also have an open listening ear to discuss a constant dialogue with their employees. If you don't have that constant dialogue, it's going to become mantra.
And I mean, Anthony, don't get me wrong, I completely agree. This is all great stuff. But some of this is pretty complicated to implement in practice. I mean, if you want to have a listening culture, for example, well, then you're going to have to listen. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's a bit like a dragnet. You're going to pick up a lot of other things that maybe you didn't want to deal with as a manager when you have a listening culture. And, you know, some of it might be really important material that you as a manager need to deal with and help employees in terms of finding the right solutions. Other bits might be completely useless, might be wrong, or might be the result of an employee's personal disagreement with something. So having a listening culture isn't just about, you know, saying we'll listen to everything. It's also about listening, responding thoughtfully, following through.
Absolutely.
So this takes quite a bit of work. And I think for me, that's part of the explanation as to why some companies just don't make it in terms of really fully fostering an ethical conduct. Because ultimately, it's a whole lot easier to just say, well, look, we've got a code of conduct. And we have an employee town hall once a year where we talk about ethics and that's it, versus really embedding this into the way you are at work every day. It's not without effort and strain.
Yeah. A corporate culture, once established, you've said it yourself outside the podcast, it's like a super tanker. It's very, very difficult to change course. And I think it's obviously much easier to deal with a small one-masted sailing yacht and try and get the culture change on board that than it is on board a super tanker. You also said, I remember, that you can change direction 5 degrees at a time on a super tanker. So it is a long slog. And the bigger the organization, the harder it is to do. I've seen a number of culture change projects and I've seen them fail because they're trying to do everything all at once. Because things have to happen now. We have to act, we have to change, we have to show that we're changing. And in fact, you see that people don't really believe in it and therefore it doesn't happen. So I think the only way to do these things is to do them bit by bit, start experimentation on small scale and let those small scales become wins and then amplify and demonstrate how this new culture performs better. In a smaller company, it's much better to start early. In a big company, it's very, very difficult to do. And I don't contest that. But I would say that doesn't mean you don't allow yourself to have the aspirational direction to work towards. There are many, many small steps that you can take that'll simply continuously bring the subject up, make people think about what they're doing, and actually at least improve the culture by letting them understand this is the direction of travel.
That's
right. Maybe we haven't clarified all of the points. Maybe we haven't got everything right. But you know what? This company, we're trying to change towards behaving in a more responsible way. So, okay, if we're going to be more responsible, well, who are stakeholders? Who are the people that we're supposed to be impacting in a better way? And try and make sure that your remuneration systems, your evaluation systems also reflect this. But you have to start small. You have to start with small units that you can actually manage to do it. And of course, a long-term recruitment policy to get the right kind of people who have these kind of values. I won't say ethical standards, we already discounted those, but the right kind of values to drive forward a certain type of behavior.
Oh, that's right. And the kind of discussion that we're having, this is the kind of discussion that needs to happen regularly at the office. I think for many people, they can't even imagine having this kind of discussion at work with coworkers. But just starting to talk about these issues actually puts this on the table as an agenda item. And just for the record, I know that many of our students are interested in a very positive and optimistic career in the corporate world. So for the record, I view it more as a cruise ship as opposed to a super tanker.
Oh, very nice. Yes. Okay. Well, whatever happens, as you said, I think we need to talk about these things in the boardroom, in the executive meetings, and in fact, in the office meetings. much more frequently. So I think we better stop this podcast and get out and start doing it, right?
All right. See you next semester.
Okay. You too. Bye.
Bye.
That was the Management 291 podcast with Michael Schweiger and Anthony Smith-Meyer. Music by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com. Thank you for listening.